Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Overdose deaths from opioids continue to be an epidemic in Pennsylvania and across the country. If there is good news, it is that everyone knows it, are fighting back, and trying to help those afflicted with the disease of addiction. Pennsylvania's seven public media stations are collaborating in a project called Battling Opioids. It starts this week with a goal to tell stories to inform Pennsylvanians, but also to provide resources to fight the battle, Battling Opioids. Joining us to talk about this project is WITF's Director of Programming and Promotion, Fred Vigent, and WITF's Transforming Health Reporter, Brett Shoulders. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Scott.
Fred, you're busy today.
I am.
Morning news, morning edition, and here you are again. But let me tell our listeners that if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Fred Vigent, let me start with you. What is Battling Opioids?
Battling Opioids is a multimedia collaborative project that is involving WITF and the other six public media stations across the Commonwealth, focusing on the opioid epidemic. This was a project that was launched in response to Governor Tom Wolf's declaration of emergency about the opioid epidemic that are affecting many residents in the state. And, you know, WITF has been focusing on this issue for many years. I was thinking about it this morning. Late 2014, 2015, Ben Allen started doing some work on this, focusing on drugs in young people. And then it continued reporting on it, and Brett Shultes has followed up on Ben's work from a number of years ago on just how this continues to be an issue and how there's the rate of death continues to increase based on what we're finding on the trends for this issue. So we, as a collaboration, we thought the stations can all come together and kind of team our efforts together to really help bring a greater attention, greater detail to this issue, as well as the fact that, you know, we all know our communities very well, WITF here in South Central Pennsylvania, but the stations in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and State College, Erie, and Scranton, and so that we can all kind of reach out into our communities to kind of share in the efforts and show, you know, how this is a problem across the Commonwealth.
So what's different about Battling Opioids?
Well, I mean, WITF and these other stations, you know, we're taking a multimedia approach to this and a long-term approach to this. This isn't a situation where, you know, we're coming in, you know, I'm reading the newscast and saying, this is a headline, this is important, this is an issue, and then the next day moving on to the next issue. I mean, this is, we launched this comprehensive project back in March with a documentary produced by WQED in Pittsburgh, and we have a culminating production airing this Thursday at 8 o'clock across the state. But this will continue. Coverage will continue with another documentary airing in December, and we're looking at future productions that will come up in February and in April.
Just to provide a little bit of context here, 13 people on average are dying every day in Pennsylvania of opioid overdoses. That is one of the highest rates in the country. This is not just a Pennsylvania issue. It is a problem across the country. So, Brett Shultes, this is your beat almost every day.
I mean, yeah.
You're working with on a lot of other health-related stories and transforming health, but this is a big part of it. If you could kind of describe, and I'm going to ask that of we have other guests coming up a little bit later in the program from Gaudenzia and also from the Pennsylvania Medical Society, or I'll ask the same question, but your observation of, I don't know, kind of a report card of where we are today. Because we've been talking about this, as Fred said, for several years now. Where are we today with the opioid crisis?
Right, right. The first thing you need to understand is that the when you look at those numbers, that overdose death rate that we often use as a sort of marker of whether things are getting worse or whether they might be getting better, like with a lot of things, I mean, listen, every time somebody dies of a drug overdose, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for that family and for a whole community. But in addition to that, it becomes a piece of statistics. And that number is going to keep going up, unfortunately, even as things may be getting better. And that doesn't mean that those who are invested in fighting the opioid crisis are doing a bad job. It just means that a lot of people who are addicted to opioids now, they will continue to fight that fight for years to come. And sadly, some may not win that fight. And so that's why we're seeing that continue to climb. And, you know, in case anybody doesn't know that, the death rate, broadly speaking, has continued to climb year over year, sometimes as high as 40%. I think we had two back-to-back years of 40% increases. And now, that said, you see some pockets, some individual communities that are faring better than they were the previous year. So there are a lot of smaller variable factors when you look at that. But I think, you know, when you to your question of what's changed and what's the report card, one of the biggest things that's changed since I started reporting on this, and even before I was on the health beat and before I was at WITF, is I think that we've reached a point where the public understands that this is an epidemic, is a crisis. It's not an isolated thing. And so the response to it has become much more systematized. As Fred said, we have the governor's declaration. We have the state sort of dedicated to solving the problem. And it takes a while for that to pan out, but I think that we are reaching a point where everybody's efforts are a lot more integrated and systematic.
Well, the frustrating part about that is, and I said that in my introduction, that I think most people are aware that there is an epidemic, there is a crisis out there, but when you see numbers going up of right. overdose deaths, and almost everyone, this is a situation where almost everyone knows someone or knows a family that has lost a loved one,
yeah.
or if not have died from an overdose, at least know someone who is finally fighting that battle against opioid. And I say frustrated. I don't know whether that's the right word or not, but when you keep using words like fighting the battle and right. trying to win the war, I don't know whether that is a good way to describe it or not, but how else to describe it? Because, you know, it is a fight against it, against opioids and against addiction, against, you know, trying to get people, trying to save lives.
That's right. And the narrative is starting to evolve on that as well. You know, I produced a report last week that was, I think it was out of University of Pittsburgh, Graduate School of Public Health, that it was one of the most surprising reports I saw recently, which showed that actually drug overdose deaths had been increasing before the proliferation of prescription drugs in the mid-90s that has become so synonymous with the cause of the rise in heroin addiction and of all these overdose deaths. So that speaks to a point that even outside of the scope of opioids, addiction is an issue that has to be addressed. And so I think as we see that, the narrative is starting to also evolve even past the idea of, okay, prescription opioids can be super addictive for some for a lot of people. Heroin is being laced with fentanyl and that's killing a lot of people. I think a lot of people know that at this point. Now the narrative is evolving to what else can we do to address the reasons that people go to opioids or other street drugs in the first place.
Fred, what are some of the topics? I mean, this is, as you described, not just a single thing. This is an ongoing project battling opioids. But what are some of the topics that will be addressed?
Well, and this kind of builds on what you were just talking about, Scott. I think one of the big issues is trying to reduce stigma. One of the goals in this project is to reduce just the stigma. And one of the themes we were seeing early on, Scott, if you remember when we were starting this coverage in this area, is that there was a lot of, people might know somebody that's affected, but not in my backyard. This isn't actually happening around here. And I think that's one of the goals we're trying to demonstrate, that there isn't any preconceived, it's this type of person or it's from this community. It's happening everywhere in every community, you know, no matter what the circumstances are. And so that is a theme you will see coming up on Thursday on the program, is that it's not just, you need to kind of move away from these preconceived notions of what, you know, an opioid addict could be or would be. And so that's one of the goals. Another goal is to just overall improve awareness of this issue and to help or share information on how people can get help. And it's a 60-minute documentary, kind of documentary magazine production, followed by a 30-minute discussion that will happen live with some state leaders that will help share the information on where you can go, the phone numbers, the websites to go to get help if you need it.
Fred Vigent is WITF's Director of Programming and Promotion, WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Shoulders, who will be joining us again in just a few minutes. But, gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Along the lines of what Fred just described about where you can find people who are battling opioids right now. Here's an excerpt from the program from Thursday night.
Addicts are a hugely diverse group of people. Upper class, lower class, doesn't make a big difference.
In northeastern Pennsylvania, it wasn't taking place in bedroom communities. Well, now all of a sudden it did.
And a lot of patients are started on prescription medications, but not by a doctor. They go to a party and somebody's got a bottle of prescription medications and they're passing them out. And that's how a lot of people get started.
It's not a walk-away drug. Your body becomes physically dependent on those medications.
It's not a question of getting high anymore. This is a question of just feeling normal.
And that's an excerpt from the first episode of Battling Opioids on Thursday night that will air on WITF and the other six public TV stations across the state. Joining me now is Dr. John Gallagher, chair of the Pennsylvania Medical Society's Opioid Advisory Task Force. Dr. Gallagher, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you.
Also joining us is Matthew Null, referral development manager with Gedenzia Addiction Treatment and Recovery Centers. Matthew Null, good to see you again.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us today.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I'm going to ask the same question that I ask of Fred and Brett about the status. If you could provide a report card of where we are. Dr. Gallagher, you are part of the Pennsylvania Medical Society's Opioid Advisory Task Force. What are you hearing from your members? What are they saying about the opioid crisis in Pennsylvania?
Oh, we're seeing it on a daily basis. I don't think there's a specialty out there that isn't faced with patients coming in who are either using these medications through prescriptions or who have started using them, misusing them in improper methods at this point. We are still starting to see some signs that the needle may be moving a little bit. But unfortunately, I think what we have to remember is this crisis took years to develop. It's not going to get fixed overnight. So when we see these little blips in the statistics, we're hopeful. But there's good evidence out there, estimates, that we're not going to see the real turn in this epidemic, given our current rates, till probably 2022 to 2025. And that at current rates that we're going, we could lose another 500,000 Americans over that period of time. So everybody pulling together to work on that. And that's where the Medical Society has been actively trying to work on the different components of this epidemic. We have seen some changes nationwide. With the decrease in opioid prescribing, Pennsylvania itself actually saw the second largest drop in opioid prescriptions in 2017 with about a 12 to 15% drop. But even saying that, that's a great change. But if you look at those numbers compared to, say, 2011, before things really got worse, we're still way above where we should be at this point, too.
Is that what you just said? Is that what you meant when you said that we may see a change in the needle and that maybe we are seeing some reason for optimism that things are getting a little bit better?
Right. There's a couple of reports that just came out last week. SAMHSA, the Substance Use and Mental Health Agency that monitors this problem, did see a significant decline in hydrocodone misuse from 2016. And if we looked at the number of individuals using prescription opioid disorder at that same time, did decline markedly from 2015. They also showed that the number of new heroin users went down markedly from about 117,000 in 2016 to only 81,000. I hate to say only 81,000, but that's a marked drop over that period of time. Unfortunately, as your other guest talking at Cadenza, the need for treatment is that even when we have these small numbers that increase every year, they get added on to the people using these medications, especially heroin, that already exists, so the numbers continue to increase. We're also concerned as we are limiting the number of prescriptions going out there. We are cutting down diversion by working with the Attorney General's office, doing drug take-back boxes and things like that, that as the supply in the pipeline decreases, people are going to be increasingly moving to heroin as the only alternative they have, which is why treatment is going to become so important as we move on.
Well, let's talk about treatment. Matthew Knoll, Referral Development Manager with Cadenza. So I'll ask that broad question, Matthew. What are you seeing on the front lines right now?
As a part of my job, I get to go around all of central Pennsylvania and work with different communities and counties. And some of the counties are reporting a decrease in overdoses and a decrease in overdose deaths. But just because we see those numbers, it doesn't necessarily mean there's less people using drugs. We are seeing people changing, and this was kind of predicted. When there's a perceived risk of a drug is very high, the use goes down and vice versa. And it's very obvious that the perceived risk of heroin is extremely high. So just because the overdose deaths and overdoses are going down doesn't necessarily mean there's less people using drugs. It's just we are seeing a change in what some of their drugs of choice are. So just like the doctor stated, we're seeing less people, new users of heroin, well, because they're turning to other drugs. And that's a big concern for ours because we don't want to see these numbers go down and everyone like, hip, hip, hooray, yay, we did it, you know, it's fixed and everything. That need for treatment and the need to help people might be there, but we're not seeing the deaths occurring.
Are more people seeking treatment?
We have close to 180 programs. We're up and running. We're up and running strong. We have a phenomenal staff working at those programs, and the need is there. We are very busy. And doing everything that we can to get everybody into treatment that we can. So people are turning to us for sure.
But my question is, are more people seeking treatment?
It's hard to look at those.
Yes on that, Scott, because in that same study we'd mentioned before, they showed that the number of people over 12 who sought treatment in 2017 was significantly higher than it was in 2015. And with a lot of the plans from the governors here in Pennsylvania, other states are being very aggressive in increasing access to treatment, we see a significant increase in the number of people seeking treatment. What we always have to remember is that only about 10% of patients with a substance use disorder actually get treatment, compared to 57% of those with a mental health disorder. So we're dealing with the stigma that your previous guest talked about. We need to get these people to treatment. And agencies like Cadenza, that are the places that we can refer to, become essential to solving the problem.
I totally agree with that. And yes, we are definitely seeing people reach out, you know, to get help with the treatment. You know, other things that we're seeing as far as the needle turning is the number of reported Narcan saves.
Narcan, okay. See, that was something else I was going to bring up. Does that skew the statistics as far as overdose deaths go?
It does. We have to make sure that we take that into account with the data.
Just for background purposes, right. I think most people are aware, but Narcan is it's an antidote to overdose for opioids. And first responders, police officers, EMTs, there are many people now, you can buy it over the counter, that do have Narcan and have been able to use it to save some people's lives from dying of opioid. Sorry, I had to interrupt you.
That's right. It's an amazing drug. It saved thousands of lives. We're seeing the numbers of reported use go down, but we also know that there's a lot of people that have it on their personal selves. So those numbers aren't being factored in there. The state has done a phenomenal job getting Narcan out and about to anybody that might be needing it, whether being schools or just families. You have a loved one that you know is using opioids, having Narcan at the home is very critical. So again, we just want to use caution when we see some of these numbers. It's a huge complex web And there's many, many different aspects of that, and we want to make sure that we keep that in mind.
We're going to be talking more about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are in the midst of WITF's fall fundraising campaign, and Brett Shouldes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, joins us again. Brett, welcome back to the program. Seems like it was just 10 minutes ago you were on with us.
You know, it's almost as if I didn't even leave the studio.
It is like that, but very important time of year, very important discussion today, and that's what WITF and public media is all about, is addressing topics like the opioid crisis.
Yeah, and Transforming Health opioid coverage is just one of many examples of the kind of importance public, first of all, accountability, and also community-based and regional-based journalism that we provide. And we play an essential role in your community, and we turn to you for our support to help us to do the job that we seek to do. You support public radio's journalists with your annual gift, with your ongoing monthly gift, or with your extra gift given through our fall membership campaign. And your support really fuels that work. We can't do it without you. We seek every day to shine a bright light on what can be life-changing decisions, whether those are things that are happening like we talked about a little bit ago with the governor declaring a disaster emergency. That's the one end of it, what happens in the state house, the policy changes. The other end of it is also what happens in your neighborhood, in your backyard, and in your house, and how those things interact. We seek to report on those things every day, and we need your help to be able to do that. So I know you've just a reminder, it's WITF.org/givenow, or give us a call at 1-800-233-9483.
Yeah, we have a goal of $500, raising $500 during Smart Talk, and I know we have a lot of loyal Smart Talk listeners out there who this is WITF's local production, daily production, but it does cost money for this program, for Morning Edition, all things considered, all the NPR programming that you hear on WITF. Those things all cost money. So we do ask, we only come to you a few times during the year to ask that you support the WITF financially. So we ask that you do that today. Brett, again, I think that this is one of the most important issues that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the United States is facing right now, this opioid epidemic, opioid crisis. And, you know, as we've detailed, WITF has been focusing on it for at least the last 4 years now, but it's ever changing. But still, there are some of the parts of the story that exist 4 years ago still exist today.
Well, this is one of those great examples of where public media can really do a great job, because we're able to stay with the story, and we have stayed with the story as it's evolved and as it's changed, because we're committed to reporting on that, whether it's a story that's the highest interest story of the day, or whether we're just down there continuing to cover something that, you know, may not be the top news story that day. I know that's the way I feel when I hear something new is happening on the front with opioids, with whether it's policy decisions or health systems making changes to the way they do things, I'm covering it. And that's because listeners have given me that mandate to do that. And that's why we need your support, so that I can continue to do that, and so that all of our other great reporters can continue to do that as well. Whether we're talking about coverage of the gas industry and energy with Marie Cusick, whether we're talking about Keystone Crossroads and all the amazing work that Emily Previty has done, or Katie Meyer's State House coverage as well. Everybody is working on their coverage area, dedicated every day. But we need you to help us be able to do that.
And how can they do that?
They can make a, you can make a contribution today, and you can go to WITF.org/givenow or call 1-800-233-9483.
Brett Shouldes, we'll talk to you again in just a few minutes. If you're just joining us on today's Smart Talk, we're talking about a new project of Pennsylvania's public media stations across the state. I say a new project, new in that we have we're collaborating, the seven stations on TV and other media across Pennsylvania, but all of the stations have been working on this, covering and producing programming having to do with the opioid crisis in Pennsylvania. Our guest during this portion of the program is Matthew Null, Referral Development Manager Manager with Gaudenzia Addiction Treatment and Recovery Centers, and Dr. John Gallagher, Chair of the Pennsylvania Medical Society's Opioid Advisory Task Force. If you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And by the way, that is a different number than the number, the 800 number you call to contribute to WITF. Now, before we go on to, because we're getting some phone calls now, and I wanted to, you know, just provide some context, some background, because that's what we do. But Dr. Gallagher, and Matthew, I'm going to ask you the same question, but this opioid crisis kind of got its start with many people who became addicted to prescription opioids, whether they had a bad back, whether they had a dental problem. They were looking for painkillers. Once those painkillers, the prescription ran out, if they couldn't find that prescription, couldn't buy it on the street, many people turned to heroin. One of the reasons was because it became so cheap. I mean, there are places in Pennsylvania where a bag of heroin could be purchased for $5. So that's kind of the a genesis of how this this occurred. So, Dr. Gallagher, let me ask this question. Are we still, you talked about how Pennsylvania has gotten opioid prescriptions under control, but is that still how many people are becoming addicted, or are there people just going right to heroin?
Well, you're always going to have a certain amount of people who will do just pure recreational use, those looking for the experience. More important, though, is the fact that it seems to get lost in the shelf a lot is the socioeconomic cost, that many of the patients who got started on drugs early were patients with pain. And if you read the book Dreamland of Michael Cisneros, he does a nice description of how in especially rural parts of America, when the economy sunk down, many people were losing their jobs, couldn't handle it, and were looking for ways to make do. They were seeing more pain because of the emotional stress that went on there, too. Many of them were coming in with chronic pain syndromes. We know that 20% of the American public today has some degree of chronic pain. So these patients were being treated, they got hooked onto it, and then they were able to get onto a disability, which gave them some income, and there became a lot of secondary issues that kept it going down the line there, too. So we have the two groups. We have those that are using the medications, and we know that 80% of those who use heroin today initially started with an either prescribed opioid or a diverted opioid, which is why we're focusing so much on that pipeline right now. But we have to look at the socioeconomic conditions that lead to this as well.
We have a phone caller coming up in just a minute who wants to talk about pain management, and we'll do that in just a moment. But Matthew, what are you seeing as far as the treatment side? Are you seeing people who, are you treating people for prescription drugs, treating them for heroin, fentanyl, some of the other drugs that are out there?
Yes, yes, and
yeah,
yes.
That's what I thought, yeah.
we see a wide range of drugs of choice. We also see a wide range of secondary drugs of choice, whereas they cannot get, you know, the opioids, well, they're going to turn to something else. And we have to keep in mind there's three different pathways of someone becoming addiction. We could have a whole hour show just on those alone. But to summarize them very quickly, some people will just have an allergy to that, an alcoholic. Their body processes alcohol different from a non-alcoholic. They actually make an acetate that gives them a whole different feeling than what someone else does that doesn't have that allergy to that. So there's some people will really hone in on one certain drug based on how their body responds to that. So that's one pathway. Another one is the more use that a person has and the intensity of the use, there's brain change going on, you know, and that is going to change all their, you know, endorphins and all kinds of chemicals, but which, again, we don't have time to really go into. So we will see those gateway drugs, whereas I'm taking maybe marijuana or other drugs, alcohol, and I need more, and my brain is changing. And then the third pathway is the spirituality and what's going on in that person's life. Are they trying to escape something? We kind of say there are some people using drugs to experience new feelings, and then we have a group of people that are using drugs to escape feelings because they don't want to feel. And so that's what we really try to do at treatment is peel off those layers. What's going on in that individual's life that possibly they're trying to escape from? And sometimes it is the mess that the addiction has caused. The shame and guilt of someone in addiction is extremely strong. It is this massive weight on their shoulders. They might not show it, they might express it, but it's there. And that's why treatment takes some time, because we really, it's not a quick, easy fix. We need to dig down into those pathways, what's going on in that individual's life, and get them back up on their feet and give them hope.
Is 28 days enough?
No.
Okay. Why do you say that?
I mean, evidence, working with, you know, Cadenzi has been around for 50 years. We are tried and true, and we know the longer that we can get a person into treatment, their success rate goes up. We want to be working with that individual and their family for up to a year as they process through the continuum of care. An individual might come in to our detox facility and then go into short-term or long-term, but we want them to then go into outpatient, intensive outpatient programs so that we can give them everything that they need to get their life back together again.
But how do they pay for it?
In some situations, it's private insurance. Some situations, it's out of pocket. At Cadenzia, a large portion of our clients, we find the funding for them. There's resources out there. So if there's someone listening right now and they're like, hey, I really need to get in treatment, but I don't have the money for it, call us. We will help you. There's many, many resources out there, you know, for that. And that extended, that long-term treatment is what's key. The longer we can get a person into treatment and involved in their life and helping them, because in 28 days, the fog's just barely lifting. That's not enough time to build relationships and help them even get their job back, get their children back, you know, and all those relationships that need to be mended.
Why then was 28 days, is that 4 weeks, 28 days, why then is kind of that kind of a benchmark as the minimum for someone needs treatment?
In this opioid epidemic, there's a lot of money to be made and there's a lot of money to be saved. And I think that's one thing that we want to keep in mind is what is best for the individual. And we see different companies kind of popping up or hey, here's a better pathway. The 28 days, I don't have an answer for that, where that originally, you know, came from. And a lot of families will turn to us and be like, oh, I can send my loved one, you know, 30 days, 28 days. They're going to come back fixed and we're good. And it's a lifelong process, you know, getting in there. I know the insurance companies have a lot to do with what they're willing to cover. And that's a shame because these people need help and for more than 28 days.
Let's take some phone calls. Caroline is in York. Caroline, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I would like to discuss the flip side of that. My partner has a leg. He's in chronic pain. He went through 12 years of leg surgeries. He had gangrene. Instead of cutting off his leg, he went to a WizKid in Houston, Texas, and they saved his leg. But it's totally titanium rods in his left leg. He has no kneecap. He is in chronic pain. They would never give enough OxyContin to keep him totally out of pain. But now that the whole opioid craze is going, it's really unfair to people that need pain medication to just have a functioning life, which my partner does. He literally has, he was willing to be the guinea pig. He went through about 32 surgeries. He still has his leg, and he's in chronic pain, but because of the opioid crisis and all the people that are abusing opioids, people like my partner, who can never totally be out of pain, but they're cutting down his OxyContin now because of the nationwide epidemic. And so he is suffering and even being in more pain in his daily life. And so it's really unfair to people that are in chronic, serious pain and really need opioids. They have to suffer because of all the other people that just take them to get high.
Caroline, thank you very much for your call, because you raised a great point. I've heard from many people when we've talked about the opioid crisis in the past on the program who have said almost the exact same thing. So, Dr. Gallagher, let me ask you about that. Yes, people like Caroline's partner that she just described, 32 surgeries, and I can imagine that someone like that is in constant pain. What about that? I mean, pain management has become, it's different now because of people abusing opioids.
Well, I don't know if it's as much the abusing of opioids plays a role. And these are the sad stories we hear all the time, and we don't want our patients to suffer. But unfortunately, there is no evidence that opioids treat chronic pain. These are what we were sold on, and we were using those. But the evidence of use for opioids stopped after about 6 months. So that we find that many patients who are on long-term opioids, especially OxyContin, the higher doses, once you get above 100 morphine milliequivalents, there's really no benefit to that amount. And so that's why we try and taper and put our guidelines that we should be maintaining those levels or smaller. And so that many of these patients will benefit from other pain management techniques. And that's where the whole school is going right now, to get access to these centers. There are several good centers across the country, but finding where they are, where the access is important. But opioids really are not a treatment for chronic pain.
Well, okay, what are some of those other pain management? And I'm sure that Caroline is out there listening right now saying, but he had less pain when he was using OxyContin, for example. So what are some of those other pain management methods?
Well, and to start with, there are very good studies that show out there that many people, when they decrease their OxyContin and their high doses, actually see pain improvement because they generate more pain with those higher doses long-term uses. Now, the other therapies, everything from physical therapy, TENS units, other medications, Neurontin, gabapentin, that are neuroagents that treat the pain management, hypnosis. You know, unfortunately, as a gynecologist, that's outside my field, but I know there are experts at University of Pennsylvania, Allegheny, and other centers throughout the state that have access to many techniques that can help these patients show significant improvement. And that's one of the things we're trying to do at the Medical Society, is train our physicians on what are the alternatives that we were never really taught for chronic pain management, and where are the centers and references, referral centers, that we can get our patients into. One of the things the Department of Health is actually trying to set up is a hub-and-spoke model, so that some of these centers of excellence for chronic pain can use their techniques and work with rural physicians and more local physicians to work together to try and help these patients.
Let's take a call from Bill in Waynesboro. Bill, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. I realize this program is largely about treatment for opioids. I feel like something that is often left out of the conversation concerning the opioid crisis is one of the very important root causes, and that is, it's very well documented that the pharmaceutical companies planned and directed a program, especially at doctors, encouraging them to prescribe opioids. And this is really, you know, one of the root causes of what's being talked about today. It has resulted in death, in pain, in families with lost members, all the things that have been talked about. And the people responsible for this, I believe, should be put in jail. The company should be fined millions for what they have caused. And I just think that should also be part of the conversation.
Well,
and sorry for being a little bit off
topic. Oh, no, you're not. You're exactly on topic, Bill, because, you know, this is kind of a wide-ranging conversation. And you're right that several state governments and even local governments have sued pharmaceutical companies because they said they were misled. Doctors were misled about how addictive some of these opioids could be. Bill, thank you very much for your call. So, Dr. Gallagher, let me start with you. What about the pharmaceutical companies and their responsibility in this?
Well, there's no doubt that there's responsibility. It goes all around, though. Physicians are designed to help their patients. And back in the 90s, people came out and said physicians were not adequately treating pain, and we were told we had to be more aggressive. And we responded that said, we want to help our patients. If we're not treating right, let's do it. At the same time, OxyContin and some of the other medications came out, and pharma came in and marketed as non-addictive alternatives based on poor science, and they convinced doctors to do that. There were areas where the DEA recognized too many pharmaceutical doses were being sent out and didn't act. So pharma plays a role, physicians play a role, patients play a role, because pain is a part of our life. We don't want people to suffer, but we can make everybody pain-free. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around there, too. Whether we hold pharma responsible, we don't have a position on that, but many states are doing that, and that does seem to be one route to follow up on this.
Matthew?
As I stated early, with this epidemic, there's money to be made, and there's money to be saved. And I think that I just... kind of my battle cry is, let's learn from this. And as we move forward and we look at other treatment options and things like that, let's make sure that we don't repeat this again. And so we want to keep that in mind, with sometimes that entice of money, and it's a business, and there's people out there who will try to hone in and make money off of this, unfortunately. And so let's just make sure that we use this with caution as we take a look at the future and making sure that we don't repeat this again.
Let's go to Jaime in Carlisle. Jaime, you're on the air.
Hello. Good morning. And I wanted to make a comment about something that was said earlier in the program, and that's treatment. My son passed away about 3 years ago of heroin overdose that was laced with fentanyl. And we tried for years to help him, multiple treatments, and it was horribly expensive, about $30,000 for up to $30,000 for a 30-day stay in treatment in-house. There was very little done. Treatment to psychiatrists often took, or psychiatrists often took, up to 3 months to get. And I think people think of this as a psychological issue, and it is to a certain degree, but it's biochemical. And, stuff like AA has only a success rate of like 10 or 15%, and it's just, if the biochemical aspect seems not to be addressed, it's almost impossible to get Suboxone to help some of these people. And I just would like the folks there to respond to my comment.
So, Jaime, first of all, I'm sorry for the loss of your son. What was your son's name?
Eugene Manuel.
And how long did he fight this battle?
For about 4 years. He went to about 5 treatment centers. And oh, can I add one more thing, Scott?
Sure.
I want to point out that this is everybody. My son was a merit scholar. He got 6 free rides to colleges. He was in the 98th percentile of SATs. He was brilliant. He had something like 25, 30 credits of college AP, and he was loved and typical middle class family, and this is everyone. Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm very sorry for the loss. Thank you very much for calling in. So I got to tell you just how sad that is to hear, Matthew, and I'm sure those stories are too commonplace today.
It happens every day in my career.
So the point he was making, though, that, and he made a couple of points, but
yes.
Number one, cost.
Yes.
We talked a little bit earlier about money. But another point that Jaime brought up is that access to treatment. Okay, Gaudenzia is there. But there are many more people who are suffering from addiction than there are treatment centers, that there are beds for them to be treated. What do we do about that?
That's a really tough question, in that we have facilities out there. It is, unfortunately, a balance in that, I hate to use this word, that is a business. We would love to build 100 more facilities and have a bed guaranteed available. However, we need to make sure that we can run our business as well. So it's that balance with that. When it comes to some of those large price tags, I think when someone reaches out for treatment help and they're asked to put a second mortgage on their house, you know, or take out some retirement, or the first question that when they call a treatment provider is, do you have insurance? These are some red flags that kind of need to go up. And some of the facilities are amazing, but do you need your own personal chef? Do you need a massage every day? The pathway for recovery comes in many, many different forms out there. And I think turning to those treatment programs that have been around for a long time, they're tried and true. Thousands of clients have come through their facilities. There's a reason why they've been around that long. It is not a quick fix. It often does not work the very first time. However, it is a process. If a person is in treatment several times, they're learning each of those times. And he brings up a very good point about the biochemical, and that's extremely important. And I think that's some important information to get out to everyone. I know when I work with people and they're working with a loved one and just explaining to someone what's going on chemically in their body, they're not a bad person. And it's not a moral failure on their part, but understanding what's going on in their brain and the chemicals. And that's the part that takes time. We said about the 28 days, we feel until 90-day point of keeping someone absent from drugs and alcohol, that's when we start to see that brain change come back. It takes time, but we need those safeguards to be able to buy that person 90 days, you know, and keep them the drugs out of their system so we can start to see that biochemical change come back. So that biochemical change and understanding that is extremely critical to understanding what is addiction and why is that person not able to stop using.
We're almost out of time. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. One quick question here, and I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but Nancy in Franklin County said she heard a political candidate say the other night that McConnellsburg is the opioid capital of Pennsylvania. Anyone know anything about that?
That I don't.
No. Well, I think the point that Nancy makes is that there are a lot of rural areas, and McConnellsburg certainly is one of those, a lot of rural areas in this state where it's, and again, that's one of the things that's different here, is that a lot of people thought of opioids and the epidemic, the crisis just being an inner city problem. Well, that is not the case. Jaime pointed that out by talking about his son, describing his son, and McConnellsburg, certainly other rural areas of Pennsylvania. Dr. John Gallagher, chair of the Pennsylvania Medical Society Opioid Advisory Task Force, Matthew Null, referral development manager with Gaudenzi Addiction Treatment and Recovery Centers. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you for the invitation, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. And as we're coming up on the end of Smart Talk, it is WITF's fall fundraising campaign. WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Schultes is with us. And Brett, I have to tell you that that last caller just really got to me, because it's something you had said earlier, that this is not just, we hear statistics, we hear numbers, but these are real people that we're talking about. And there's a family that will be suffering from the loss of their son for the rest of their lives. And that's why it is so important to tell these stories and to have discussions like this.
It never stops being important to do that.
Are you good there? Yeah. It never stops being important to do that. I get calls from people while I'm working on other stories, and sometimes I just have to stop what I'm working on and listen, because they want to share their story with me of losing someone to addiction. And they're doing that because they know that WITF has been covering this and will continue to cover it. So I always stop and I listen, for one thing, because it's, as you said, you know, with the man who called in today, it's a very powerful and sad story. And we have to always keep that at the forefront. The minute that we turn this into something that's just statistics, then I think we're no longer doing our job the right way. So it's just one of the many ways in which WITF is bringing impactful and important coverage that is affecting everybody in this region in one way or another. So please support us for the work that we do. You're out there listening, and now is your chance to give back. You know, we also have one-time gifts. You know, you can certainly donate $60, $120, $365, $500 or more. You don't have to be a sustaining member. You can give a one-time gift, and that's a great way to support WITF as well. And you can give online at WITF.org/givenow or call 1-800-233-9483.
Brett Shultes, thank you very much for being with us today. We're trying to reach a goal of 500 hours during Smart Talk. Got about 200 hours more to go. So go to WITF.org/givenow, call 1-800-233-9483. And thank you very much.